The Epstein scandal is one of the biggest in living memory.
The story the files tell is one of base corruption that stains all it touches.
So why does Donald Trump want to pretend it doesn't exist?
It's pretty boring stuff. It's sordid, but it's boring.
Oh, okay, well, I guess we shouldn't worry about it then. I'm Matt Bevan, and my show, if you're listening, is rarely sordid and never boring. New episodes on ABC Listen every Tuesday and Thursday.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A heads up. If you've got kids around, this season deals with some heavy stuff. Take care while listening.
My stomach was churning. I was really worried.
It's May 2007, and Kath McDougall is about to put her suitcase into her small white rental car.
I didn't know what I could ask to try and find out without upsetting things too much.
Her daughter Chantelle and 5-year-old granddaughter Leela have turned up to say goodbye.
I sensed she was sort of concerned or worried about something.
Kath's made a trip across the country to visit them, flying into Perth and driving the 3 hours south through winding roads lined with farmland and jarrah forests to a sleepy town called Nanna. It's a quaint old timber town populated by old school hippies, timber workers and farmers. Around May, after a few decent rains, everything's starting to green up and it kind of looks like hobbit country. Something feels off.
I'd said goodnight to her the night before at the farmhouse and drove back into town, and I didn't think that they would come in.
Kath's been staying in town at the Nanup Caravan Park. She's not welcome to stay at the house.
Simon never wanted anybody around the house.
Chantelle, Leela and a man called Simon Cadwill have lived in this isolated little corner of Australia for a few years now. It's the sort of place that attracts people with alternative lifestyles and beliefs.
Come on, in the middle.
You beat them all.
Cheating!
Cheating, you've got to hop out. Don't go there.
Despite living on the other side of the country, Kath wants to be in her granddaughter Leela's life. So whenever they can pull together the money, she flies over to visit. She also wants Chantelle to know that if she ever needs to run, Kath will be there for her.
I hope I can see you next time. See ya.
And I said, oh, I didn't think I'd see you again. She said, oh, no, we thought we'd come and say goodbye. I just knew something wasn't right.
But Kath is too frightened to ask Chantelle what's going on.
I just wished I'd asked a lot more questions no matter what. I feel sick when I think about it because I could have perhaps found out more or maybe not, but I let that opportunity go.
Kath hugs Chantelle and kisses Leela and gets into the car.
By the time I left, I was feeling ill. And I drove over the little bridge and I just burst into tears because I could just feel there was something wrong. I just couldn't put my finger on it.
Call it mother's instinct, but as Kath drove out of the main street of Nanup and onto the highway, she was convinced something was seriously wrong. Kath's instincts were right.
I was always very conscious of what I'd say, what I'd ask or what I did because I didn't want to lose her. But I did in the end.
That visit would be the last time Kath would see her daughter or granddaughter.
One of Australia's most baffling missing persons cases remains unsolved.
30-year-old Chantelle McDougall and her 6-year-old daughter Leela were reported missing, along with her partner Simon Caldwell and his friend.
The family lived a bizarre alternative lifestyle.
Mr. Caldwell had been involved with a cult, adding to the puzzle of their disappearance.
He had told someone online that he was planning a family suicide pact.
In July 2007, just over a month after Kath's visit, Simon Cadwill, Chantelle and Leela McDougall, along with their friend Tony Popich, would simply vanish. They left behind the scatterings of a life and a note pinned to the door of their little blue farmhouse. It was short, written in a tight, curling handwriting. It said the four had packed up suddenly and moved to Brazil to escape sleeplessness caused by EMF, electromagnetic fields. but there's no trace they ever left the country. They were never conclusively seen again. It's been almost 20 years since the Nanup 4 disappeared. It is a complicated, tangled web. A mysterious cult leader, strange behaviour, secrets and hidden identities, and those left behind to go over and over minute details in their head, asking themselves if they could have done something differently. The more people I speak to, this same thing keeps coming up. Everyone trying to reconcile themselves to what they did do, the choices they did make, the ones they didn't. Because when something like this happens and you're left staring back, how do you live with the choices you've made? With the best of intentions, but which led you here? I reckon every journo has that one story that they can't shake, that they find themselves thinking about at 3 in the morning. This one's mine. I'm Dominique Bayens, and this is Expanse, the Nanup 4. Episode 1, The People in the Blue House. I live and work as a reporter about an hour from Nanup, and 18 years after Kath drove over that bridge, I roll across it, headed the other direction, towards Nanup. I can't get these four people out of my head, especially Leela, 5 years old when she went missing. I've spent months trying to convince people to talk to me. Every day has felt like walking on eggshells because almost 2 decades on, what happened is still raw. So why am I picking at the scab? Because the families of those four are still desperate for any new information. There's a few theories about what might have happened. Maybe they just dropped off grid, or really went to Brazil. Or it was murder. Or maybe it was a cult-inspired suicide pact between the three adults that Leela was just pulled into.
Daddy, stop doing that face.
This is one of the more disturbing possibilities of what might have happened. Trying to imagine how anyone could be so far down the rabbit hole that their child could be pulled along in the wake. So I've been trying to find someone who can give me a window into what Chantel was like as a mum. Could she have been capable of killing herself and taking her daughter with her, like all those news reports suggest? Finally, I find someone.
My name's Diane. I lived in Busselton for 20 years.
Diane Abbott gives off very practical, no-nonsense, mother-in-charge vibes. She is, in her own words, an organiser. In 2007, she and her husband were homeschooling 3 young children and running a caravan park on a picturesque stretch of land locals call the Holy Mile, in Busselton, a coastal town 40 minutes from Nanup. A lot of kids who grew up in WA, myself included, will have a story of staying at the Holy Mile for a school camp.
It was right on the beach. Our house was right at the front of the campsite, near the driveway.
As I'm speaking to Diane, there's lots of small details she doesn't remember. But she's really clear on the big things. As the organiser, Diane ran a homeschooling group for a few families. They'd join forces for the kids to play and the parents to connect.
Homeschooling wasn't a big thing. It was hard to find other people who were homeschooling to get together with.
So when a young mother called Chantel wanted to join the fortnightly meets, the door was open and the kettle was on.
She was very, very smiley, but quite softly spoken, shy. She was obviously younger than a lot of the other mums.
Photos of Chantel show an open-faced woman with a slightly buck-toothed, friendly smile, brown hair with a fringe. I can almost sense that softness that Diane talks about coming out of the shyly smiling face on my screen. This young mum, Chantel, who joined homeschool club, might have been shy, but her 5-year-old daughter, Leela, was a pocket rocket of energy.
Every time we pulled up somewhere where Leela was, as they got out of the car, she would run up to them and tag them and then say, "You're it," and then run away. Because, like, everything was, you know, active and fast. But it would be very intense and she engaged with 100% of herself.
It's a small thing, and yet I can imagine exactly the kind of kid Leela was.
Chantel listened to Leela and the way they talked respectfully. They just loved each other to bits.
That tunnel, that's it.
By and large, Diane's time with Chantel and Leela was light and fun and mundanely normal. Mums talking about mum things, sleep, food, what they've been doing with their kids lately. Then, a few months after joining the group, Chantel invited Diane and her three kids over for a play date.
It was a cut lunch and a water bag day. It was a long way.
Loaded with instructions on how to find the isolated little blue farmhouse, Diane left Busselton with her three kids in the back seat, driving the winding roads upwards and inland.
And we had new tyres and it would make our car sound like a whale. So it would go, woo, you know, like a whale.
As Diane made her way down the narrow gravel road, she could see the blue house come into view. Out the back, out of sight, was a neat white caravan, barbecue gas bottle strapped to the front. Chantel and Leela were waiting to welcome them.
She was very warm and welcoming and she was obviously thrilled that we were there and Leela was very excited.
They made their way inside.
Chantel told us right at the beginning that we needed to be quiet because Leela's dad was asleep.
Diane had a sense that Leela's dad was maybe a bit controlling.
My impression was that she was allowed to come and that Simon let them come to Busselton. It was like, oh, it's like that, is it?
Diane might have had questions, but she kept them to herself. She'd never met him before and she wasn't one to judge anyway. So they kept it down while they visited.
And, you know, like little girls, when they get together, they squeal and laugh and we probably both decided to go outside to keep them quiet.
They played with the children and chatted out in the backyard. After a while, a tall man came out and said hello with an English accent.
I probably said something like, "Oh, so you do exist, Simon. Hi," you know, because, you know, I'd heard a lot about him over the months and stuff. And, yeah, he was real.
Chantel had been coming to the homeschool meets for a few months now, and they'd talk a lot while their kids were playing. But there was a lot Diane didn't know about her. Her home life was opaque. Diane knew Chantel lived with a man called Simon Cadwell, Leela's dad, but not much else.
She was quite private and, like, I felt like I couldn't ask her things.
But finally, Diane had met Simon and he seemed fairly unremarkable.
Well, I didn't feel unwelcome. Like, I didn't feel like he was saying, why are you in my house or anything.
What was more of note to Diane was when a young man walked past. Turns out he lived in that backyard caravan.
He had dark hair and was just a, you know, average guy who said hello, but didn't stop and engage. I don't know, I just thought it was a bit odd to have a bloke living in your backyard when you've got a 7-year-old.
Did Chantel explain who he was?
She didn't elaborate and I didn't ask because it's her business, their choice.
I get the feeling Diane's kind of old school in that way, or maybe just not a nosy journalist. Diane had already picked up that maybe Chantel's home arrangement was unorthodox.
I do remember her saying to me once that she was responsible for Leela, that when she first had Leela, she was told she could have Leela, but she would be the one who did everything. Because I thought, oh, gosh, that's harsh.
How did she seem when she told you about that?
Just matter of fact. It was just, this is how it is.
But again, Diane wasn't going to tell Chantel how to live her life. At the end of their play date, they hopped back in their car and headed home. But then came something unexpected.
I'm sure it was very soon after we went to Chantel's and he rang me.
Simon, that is, ringing Diane, a man she's met all of once, fleetingly, while Diane and Chantel played with the kids in the backyard.
It was so weird.
Was the phone call expected?
No, absolutely not. Out of the blue.
Simon sounds serious and intense.
Like, this is a big thing.
What he said next left Diane very confused.
He said, you know Chantel's got end time syndrome. And I'm like, what? You know, Chantel's got end time syndrome. And I said, no, I didn't know that. Well, she does. She's got end time syndrome.
Diane's got no clue what he's talking about.
She's worried about the end of the world. That's why we don't go anywhere. I sort of got the feeling that he was trying to make excuses for Chantel. Like, Chantel's like this, and this is why. But I didn't think Chantel was like anything. I thought she was just a lovely, normal person. And it's really up to her to tell me if she's got end time syndrome. But okay, thanks for the phone call, Simon.
The phone call doesn't last more than 5 minutes and Diane hangs up.
I would not ever expect one of my friend's husbands to ring me and say something about my friend that they didn't say to me. It's just odd.
After I speak to Diane, I keep thinking about why someone's partner would call their friend and say those kind of things. And not in a concerned way, but in a way that might make their friend think they're crazy. Especially when, from everything I've read, it wasn't Chantel who was espousing ideas that the end of days was coming. It was Simon. It's not easy to decipher Simon's beliefs from his writings and online presence, but he had these ideas about different planes of existence and that graduating up the planes was all about coming closer to the truth. And he clearly didn't feel great about the way this plane of existence was rolling along, as in the world in 2007. He spoke about society heading in a bad direction toward a downfall, that the Earth was stressed, that we were, to quote, poisoning Earth's life field. There's talk about negative dark forces, and he thought electromagnetic fields were damaging Mother Earth and disturbing him personally. One of his more troubling beliefs was that to escape this plane and reach the truth, you had to die. So when he apparently calls Diane up and says Chantel had end of time syndrome, it sounds like he's using his own beliefs to plant the seed that there's something wrong with Chantel. I wanted to speak to Diane to try and understand Chantel as a mum, whether she could have been capable of something unspeakable. Instead, I've got these unsettling hints about Simon's presence in their lives and a sense that Chantel was on her own as a mum. And far from warning signs, that she and Leela were a tight-knit team.
Sure, guys.
But as I've been digging around, I've been hearing something else that is totally at odds with the normalcy of the homeschool mum view of Chantel that Diane had. There's this story from the lead-up to that July day when Chantel left a note pinned to the door saying gone to Brazil. It's so bizarre, it almost sounds made up. There's not many people who were there to witness it. But someone who was is Jodie McDonald. We sit down in a large shed, machinery around, so I can find out if this story is true.
The equivalent of the director.
When I meet her, the cliche of a true blue Aussie comes to mind.
Cool.
The person who will call a spade and isn't afraid of a hard day's work.
So back in 2007, I was in my early 40s. I was working alongside my partner at the time, who was an electrician, doing solar power.
It was a family business. Even Jodie's 10-year-old son would help out on weekends and after school.
So he was an apprentice as well, or sort of?
Slave labour, he would describe it.
Jodie would drive into Nanup two or three times a week to do her shopping. And on one of those occasions, she stopped at the local nursery.
And had a little building inside where they had on display sort of garden ornaments and pots and things like that.
It was having a closing down sale. Jodie was keen to nab a bargain, but it wasn't the greenery that caught her eye.
I'd been drawn, particularly attracted to this horse bronze statue. And I thought at the time, should I invest in that?
standing there among the flower pots, eyeing off her bronze horse statue. A worker with dark hair and eyes comes over to see if she needs help.
He said he was Tony. I just found him a very pleasant, nice, easy to talk to person who, you know, was a nice looking young man, you know, that seemed very open.
She didn't know it then, but Tony Popich would come to be at the centre of what would unfold. But on that day, he was just a friendly, chatty young man helping a lady buy a bronze horse statue.
It was cute. You know, way too young for me, but, you know.
Jodie bought the statue, and to this day, she still has it. It went straight back to her house, where it stands pride of place in her living room. As it turns out, just 400 or so metres from the little blue house and her neighbours who lived there.
In the blue house, as we used to call it, was a family who we didn't know too well, which was Chantelle and Simon and a little girl called Layla.
Layla. And that cute young man from the nursery, Tony Popich, living in the caravan out the back. Jodie didn't have much to do with the four from the blue house. Just the odd wave if they ever caught each other on the driveway. But occasionally when she and her partner Bruce were wrestling with the accounts in their office, they'd noticed some unusual movements next door. Simon coming and going a lot, which didn't fit with what they knew of him.
We saw the up and down of the driveway and thought, where's someone going for such a short time? Were they growing something in the bush?
I check with Jodie whether that something she's referring to was a weed crop.
Potentially, yes.
Yeah. At this point, Jodie and I are interrupted by a rogue fly.
Naughty fly.
My cameraman, Jeff, dashing around, fly spray in hand.
Oh, there he is. There he is. He's coming around here.
Oh, he's just there.
Probably kill us before the fly.
The glamour of making a podcast.
Right, I think it's still hopefully recording.
Fly dealt with, Jodie starts to tell me about this time she and Bruce had a job out at the Blue House. And what she says is even stranger than the stories I've heard. The Blue House is owned by a local farming couple who ran cattle. They decided to subdivide the large property the Blue House sat on. Being in the electrical business, Jodie and her partner Bruce were hired to do the wiring and connections for a new power pole transformer next to the Blue House in April 2007, 3 months before the four disappeared. It was a pretty standard job that would take a few days to finish. So on the first day, Jodie and Bruce travelled across the paddock with all their electrical gear in the ute.
We were digging a trench across and then just preparing the connections for when Western Power was actually going to turn on the actual power supply. My son had come and he was playing with the little girl.
That's Layla.
It was sort of at the end of the day. Bruce may have even had a beer and we were sitting in the backyard.
They're relaxing. The children still playing together on the trampoline. Then Tony and Simon come over. Tony as cute as ever. And Simon, eye-catching for another reason.
He just looked very red in the face. Was almost like broken out in hives.
Jodie's chatting with Tony and Simon starts talking to Bruce.
He was a little bit erratic, but then also would be sit back and chilled. So he was kind of like swapping between the two. He was explaining the concern they had over the new power pole because they were very worried about the emissions that were coming from that pole and it was going to affect them and whatever.
Simon became increasingly agitated about these emissions messing with their minds. Emissions being the EMF, electromagnetic fields, that were in that scrawled note explaining why they'd left.
My understanding is that the EMFs are like electrical currents, and I suppose because we're made up of energy ourselves, so it's all about damaging our own electrical current and making disturbances in our own current that will then create disease or disabilities.
Just to be clear, this is not something the science suggests you need to be worried about.
I'm not even sure that's 100% correct, but that is my understanding of what the paranoia is about.
Simon was convinced the EMF from this new electrical connection outside his house was the cause of his fractured and messy thoughts and these hives on his face. Bruce just turned around and said,
"It hasn't been connected. It has got no power there to do anything to you. It's not that that's made you do that, it's stress."
The conversation has become pretty awkward pretty quickly. Then Simon and Tony start telling them about the defences they've put in place.
They were telling us about the EMF balls that they had buried around the garden to stop the emissions getting them. And they were wanting to show us one.
Simon and Tony are looking around the yard
and saying, "Oh, they're around here and they've scratched up the ground with their hands, but they haven't found it." So then they're going, "Oh, move over a bit." So they're scratching around a bit more and they still can't find it. There was this mass panic because they couldn't find one that was supposed to be there. They were just like this 10 minutes of sort of like crazy, like digging. They're here somewhere. Where are they gone? Has someone taken them? Has someone removed them? Where are they? You know, they've magically disappeared. So there was a panic.
Leela hops off the trampoline and comes over to join in the search. Jody, her partner and son are watching on stunned.
My son and partner and I were kind of like looking across at each other. My son's going, "What is going on? These people are crazy looking for this like metal ball thing in the garden."
Finally, the two men and Leela uncover one of the balls. It's silver and bigger than a tennis ball, but smaller than a bowling ball. And they're holding it in the air like a precious chalice.
They were probably 10 metres apart throughout the corners of the garden, like creating like a protective barrier to the house from the ground, from the outside world.
What did you think about that?
That was strange. But then there are strange things out there, so it was just another strange thing to encounter. So, because I'm thinking, I don't see how they're going to protect you, but yeah, okay. Then they replace them carefully back into their hole in the garden and cover them back over so that they would protect them from the rays. But they, as my other half had said, the computer and the radiation from the bar radiator would be a lot greater and cause more problems.
As it turns out, Bruce was spot on. The computer would cause way more damage than any power pole, just not because of its electromagnetic field. It feels like Jody and Diane each have these isolated, strange moments. Odd encounters that alone could easily be dismissed as eccentric or not my business. But together they're starting to reveal a picture. An isolated young woman, single parenting a little girl, hints of a controlling home life. A home life that sounds like it's becoming increasingly erratic. Simon talking about end days syndrome, making odd trips up and down the driveway off the property, and of course, those balls. It was around the same time as the frenzied EMF ball search when Chantel stopped turning up to the homeschooling group with Diane.
She just stopped coming and we didn't hear, and I think a few of us rang her and there was no answer. And we just thought, well, that's not very nice of her. We were her friends and we included her in the group and she could have said something, which makes me feel awful now.
What's the question you think no one's asking that they should?
Why didn't we see any signs of what was going to happen? Why didn't anyone anticipate this? What did I miss? What did we not ask? What did we not notice?
I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, the NANUP 4. Please subscribe so you get every episode as they drop and leave a review wherever you're listening. It helps others find us too. If you can add to this story or have information you think might be important, please get in touch. This season of Expanse was developed in collaboration with ABC's regional WA team on Wadandi and Bibbulmun country. Sound design is by Grant Walter, who is also a producer, along with Megan Woods,
with additional production and research by Jessica Hinchliff, Kate Stevens and Louise Mylan. Our supervising producer is Pia Wursu. Executive producer is Blythe Moore.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.